Blog Talk Radio.
I was a hell of a handicapper, I can tell you that. I had it down so good that I ran paradise on earth. I had one of the biggest casinos in Las Vegas to run. The Tangiers. You know, if I did it, I'd have to run it my way.
Nobody's going to interfere with you running the casino, I guarantee it.
Yeah, guy. Make a lot of money for us. So keep a good eye on it.
All right. Look at this place. It's made of money. What do you think about me moving out here?
I just got to tell you, it's no joke out here. You got to keep a low profile. Right off the bat, they don't like guys like us.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
You like your money a lot, don't you?
Yes, a lot.
Well, how about that?
Yeah, I want to settle down. I want a family.
You got the wrong girl.
You'll be set up for the rest of your life.
You don't know me. What do you know me for 3 months?
They had it all. They ran the show. And it was paradise. While it lasted.
Take a vacation.
Can't make it any clearer, Sam. I would just get out.
I try to do everything for you, even though I knew deep down inside you would bury me.
I buried you. You buried yourself.
I have to be able to trust you with my life. Can I trust you? Can I trust you?
I will go to the FBI. I will go to the police. I am not trusting you anymore.
You want me to get out of my own house? You only exist out here because of me.
He's a loose cannon.
No! Stop it!
You realize what you can do? You can get us all killed!
You want to get rid of me? Here I am. Go ahead, get rid of me.
It's another edition of the New Classics tonight, where we'll be examining Martin Scorsese's 1995 film Casino. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and you are listening to possibly the greatest tribute that Casino has ever had.
That's right. Not just the movie, casinos in general.
No, but the movie. I mean, this is an underrated movie.
It is.
And, you know, we're going to admit it. It doesn't get the respect it deserves. That's why we're doing this show.
And why? Good segue. Let's start out with that. Why do you think that is? The non-respect.
I think, from what I've heard in my experiences and my travels, is that a lot of people view it as a Goodfellas retread, which mm-hmm. I think is missing the point, and I think it's just lazy criticism of the film.
Yeah. It is. Even so, watching it again last night, and I know you watched it again.
I watched it last weekend, and having the time of my life watching it, actually.
Yeah, and it does work as a nice companion piece to Goodfellas in a way. And it does have similar arcs.
Mm-hmm.
But we bring this up with Frank Vincent, and we brought it up on the show before.
Right.
Goodfellas, there's absolutely nothing wrong with Goodfellas. It's a perfect movie.
Mm-hmm.
Casino, the canvas seems a bit it's the canvas and the ambition seems a little bigger to me.
Oh, it's much bigger.
Doesn't in of itself make it a better movie. It's not a better movie. But I think it is on equal ground with Goodfellas.
Oh, without a doubt, it is definitely on equal ground with Goodfellas. There are so many interesting little set pieces, just little scenes, that you can't help. I mean, it's almost God, it's almost like a documentary in some ways.
Yeah. But the thing that makes it fly is, of course, the editing.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about ambitious. I don't know how much of this film was those little pieces and those little cuts were planned for and how much were discovered in the editing room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she edits the hell out of his movies. They work a full year just on post alone.
Right.
I mean, he's notorious for that.
Mm-hmm. And rightfully so.
And I think this is one of his best edited films and some of the best work that she's ever done, Thelma Schumacher.
Oh, without a doubt. I also think it's very interesting. I'm a friend of mine, and the same friend who thought that Heat was a ripoff of The Killer, thought the problem with this film is that the movie is too much of the soundtrack. And,
right.
And I don't agree with that at all. I think Scorsese, as with Tarantino, is a genius when it comes to soundtracks. I don't think that I think there's a lot of the film exists without the soundtrack.
It makes the quieter moments without a soundtrack behind it resonate more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Because it does have a constant barrage of music.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell when he's going for a real effect when the music stops and it's
right.
A moment of silence, you know? You know, that beating at the end, for instance.
Oh,
I mean, all you hear is the sound of the bat against
yeah.
Flash. It's an amazing movie, and it's multi-layered. It's got narration from De Niro and Pesci. And let me say, narration has to be tough for an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a special gift because you're in a booth recording narration as the character outside of the element of actually being in the moment, in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impeccable narration. And plus, let's talk about this, too. This was a banner year for De Niro, a banner season for him.
It was. It really was.
Casino at 95, like Thanksgiving weekend 95, like 2 weeks later, he came out with Heat on December
8th. It was his best year.
Yeah, yeah. And what a 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
And also a man that resisted, I don't know necessarily, but resisted love possibly for a long time. He felt he needed it at a certain
mm-hmm.
point in his life. And it couldn't work out at the end. Fate kind of stood in. And I mean, it's a different dynamic in a way, because in Heat, he couldn't leave his code. He couldn't abandon his code, so he had to abandon her.
Right.
And in Casino, he's doomed from the start. I mean, he wants so desperately for her to love him, and it just
mm-hmm.
won't happen.
No, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen at all.
But the performances are top-notch. And another thing about Pesci, which he's a presence on film that we've missed a lot
mm-hmm.
in the past years. The complaint was that his performance in particular was too much mirrored the performance he gave in Goodfellas.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that at all, because I think, you know, in Goodfellas, he's so much a loose cannon, and I know you could say, oh, he's a loose cannon in Casino, but he's really not. He really is trying to look out for Robert De Niro's interest, but after a while, it just doesn't work out that way. I think that's lazy criticism. I really do. I think that, to compare it to Goodfellas in any way, in that sense, it belittles the film, and the film is so ambitious, but also Pesci's character is really based on a notorious real life figure, and it's
mm-hmm.
not. I just don't think it's a mirror image of that other character from Goodfellas. I don't see it.
Yeah, Nicky Santoro.
I'm not trying to be loyal to the film so much. As an outside observer, I don't see it.
And the violence, too. I mean, it feels a lot. It feels like Scorsese's most violent movie.
I think it is. I think
yeah.
it really is.
And he, and we talk about it with Frank Vincent, he shot more violence than he needed because
mm-hmm.
he wanted an R rating. So when they told him to cut this or that, those were things he wanted to cut to begin with. So
right.
he made it worse than he anticipated it being ultimately, so he could get the rating he wanted. But there's the one that's talked about most often, the head in a vice scene.
Mm-hmm.
Pesci has this guy's head in a vice and his eyeball pops out.
Yeah, that's right.
And that really happened. But it happened 10 years before the movie depicts that it happened.
Right.
And that's the event that made Nicky a made guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall hearing about that scene before I saw the movie because it showed at Show West.
That's right.
In 95. And the theater owners came back, and the overwhelming response was that it's disgustingly violent. That's all they had to say about it for the most part. Isn't that something? That's what they took away from it. So I already had it in mind that, man, this is going to be a violent, really violent Scorsese movie. I mean, even unusually violent for Scorsese. So my expectations were up.
Right.
And, you know, 4 years earlier, we saw JFK.
That's true.
I always equate JFK and Casino in terms of editing, pacing, fast cutting, that kind of dynamic. A three-hour experience that goes by in a flash.
I would agree with you on that. That's an excellent analogy between those two films because it is the editing that's really the star of both films.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great stuff. For those of you that haven't seen Casino, it's about the mob infiltration of Vegas, and how that led to the downfall of the mob and the trajectory that led to their downfall in that arena. And also it pays lip service towards the end of the changing Vegas, the Disney-fied
mm-hmm.
Vegas.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That's another thing that reminds me of Goodfellas too, in that at the end, he's complaining about his life now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so romantic anymore for him.
Right.
And I recall a conversation with someone I worked with after Goodfellas came out, and he said, you know, the movie is, it's so exciting and visceral, and then it loses something. I mean, it loses steam more than halfway into it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, it's supposed to, because the excitement and the romanticism of that life loses steam and reality starts to set in. Yeah. And there might be a certain element of that in Casino as well.
Oh, I think it's in both films because, at least at the time, both films were, how should we say this, anti-Godfathers. Not that the Godfathers are bad films, but the Godfathers were fairy tales about mafia life.
Mm-hmm.
And these films, at the time, and we talk about this with Frank Vincent, but at the time were like antidotes to The Godfather. Not in the way of saying The Godfathers are bad films or anything, but they were fairy tales about mafia life in America. And while that was true at the time, these films in themselves, both of these films, I think, have romanticized the mafia in their durations of the last two decades.
Yeah.
But at the time, though, they do... You know, they were supposed to be these anti-romanticist views of organized crime.
Yeah, and based on real-life stories, actually, towards the end of shooting Goodfellas, Pileggi came up with the idea of Casino
mm-hmm.
and pitched it to Scorsese, and Scorsese got really excited about it. And he said, write the book, but let's do something different. Let's have the movie come out before the book. And so they were. It was created all at the same time. The both projects, the book and the film, and the screenplay that Pileggi helped on. And obviously, it involved real life characters. The De Niro character, Sam Rothstein, he just passed on last year, and he loved the movie, even though he knew that it took dramatic liberties here and there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And De Niro got close to Sam Rothstein, I imagine, because he. To get in more into the character, he actually used Rothstein's tailor to make his
suits.
One of the same suits. And what suits, man? Just talk about the colors in this movie, the costuming, De Niro, the clothes that he wears in this movie. I tell you, every time, I mean, this isn't a fair comparison, but every time I'd watch something like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, like 10 years ago. And I saw Regis Philbin wear the same color tie as the shirt that he had on. And I thought, well, that's like De Niro in Casino. That's such a sharp look.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And, And so much between the editing and the color and the multiple narrations and the nonstop music accompaniment and the violence and such visceral filmmaking, it really does feel like Scorsese's the ultimate juggler, and he's mm-hmm. keeping all these balls in midair for 3 hours straight.
Yes.
It's an amazing feat, and you and I both agree, Scorsese, one of the best filmmakers we've ever had, if not the best.
I think he's... It's very interesting, and it's really funny that we're doing this show, and you know, I'm sure as you know that we got the news that his newest film has been pushed back to February of next
year. Yes.
I kind of threw rocks at people when I heard this, but I don't know why. I mean, I know why from the studio's perspective, but it's still not good. But he's someone that just keeps getting better to me. He keeps finding new things, and the only other director after this weekend, I can say that about is Tarantino. I think is going to keep finding out things about himself.
Yeah.
Before this film that opened on Friday, that was debatable. But I'm willing to say that Scorsese and his offspring Tarantino find new things to say about themselves. They're able to do this, but Scorsese, especially with the partnership he took with DiCaprio, it's amazing the work that they've put out.
Yeah, and that he's come up with some of his strongest films in the past 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, but I think Casino, and a lot of people don't, I think Casino is one of his best films. I really do think it can work as a how-to if you've never been. I've never been to Vegas, but if you never don't know anything about gambling, it serves as almost a documentary. But it also is just a great story about the American dream.
Yeah, and whenever someone... I mean, it rarely happens, but whenever someone questions me and asks me what Scorsese film I'd recommend or one of my top favorite films, it's always Casino. And it's not that I'm not in love with his other work. There are tons of movies that live for me that he's made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Taxi Driver especially. Even Cape Fear is a big favorite of mine. It's Casino, I think, is the perfect confluence of his style of storytelling, of all of his skills.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's so apparent in every frame of Casino. Let's play this interview. This is an interview we did with Frank Vincent. Frank Vincent actually started his film career with Scorsese and with Pesci, who he had a comedy show with. He'd known him for many years prior.
That's right.
To Raging Bull. And he's been in a lot of terrific movies, not only Scorsese's films, but he's worked with directors like Spike Lee and Do the Right Thing and Jungle Fever and just on and on. A terrific career and a terrifically nice guy, too. It was a real treat for us to talk to him. And we started out the conversation talking about how he got started in movies and came to meet Pesci and Scorsese, and then we went on to Goodfellas and Casino from there. So enjoy this, Frank Vincent.
Well, what I did was in my career, I played music and I had a lounge band, and I did a lot of studio work as a player. And my lounge band, I developed a personality and by putting the drums up in front of the band. And doing a little shtick on the microphone with people and back and forth and developed a personality that way and then I wound up as a half of a comedy team with Mr. Pesci. Her and him and I had a comedy team where we just stood up and worked in two.
We had
a band behind us, so we did a lot of lounge work and we did a lot of work in nightclubs and we did a lot of skits and we did a lot of. That's very, very invaluable training.
Mm-hmm.
And we were approached at one point to do a film, an independent, low-budget film, that we didn't have any aspirations of doing that at that point. When I say we, I mean me, but I think Joe shared the same thing. But we were recruited to do this film. We went and auditioned, and we both got roles in this film. We didn't act together in the film, though our characters didn't know each other, but we both wound up in this independent film, And from there, we were both cast in a movie called Raging Bull.
Yes.
Mr. Scorsese put us in that film, and that's where we got our union cards, and that started off the process of the acting. And every time you do a different movie, every time you do another movie, you learn something else. So it's learned by playing by ear, I guess you might call it.
Right. And I want to get to Mr. Scorsese and these legendary films that you've been a part of. But you mentioned Mr. Pesci and your longtime relationship with him. What clicked between the two of you, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. Joe and I were I had a group, and I was playing in a local club. I had a trio, a piano trio, and I was booked to go to the New Jersey Shore on the 4th of July in 1969. I was booked to go there, and the owner of the club that we were going to in the Jersey Shore, Seaside Heights, the VIP Lounge by name, he went and he bought a piano, and we were going to play on the stage in his club for the summer. And 2 weeks prior to the job, my piano player quit.
Mm.
He said, "I can't go to the show with you." Okay, so now Joe had been coming in where I was playing in New Jersey, up here in this part of New Jersey. And he would come and sit in and sing, and we would, we just became friends. And then I said to him, "You want to go down the shore?" He said, "Yeah." And he got his guitar out, and he came down the shore with me. And before you know it, him and I were doing, we would talk to each other on the stage, and it just developed into, we really spoke the same language. Our timing was very, very similar, and we just had a natural thing for each other that came out in between the music and the comedy that we were doing. And ultimately, we just put the instruments away and we stood up and we were like a Martin and Lewis, but not as physical as that. We just talked to each other and people would laugh. So,
but when you first stepped in front of the camera with him, did the chemistry translate from the stage work you did onto film immediately? Was it there?
Oh, sure. That doesn't go away. That is there forever. That does not change. If I called Joe this minute, I would talk to him on the phone. I'd ask him, I'd say, "Yeah, so what happened? Did you talk to that guy yesterday?" And it wouldn't even be like that. I would say, "Hello, hi, it's Frank." It would be like our conversation would just continue. And
yeah,
how you doing? Yeah, everything all right? Did you talk to that guy? Whatever. Yeah, and bang, 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 bang. So we would just have that closeness. And that's there. It doesn't go away.
Yeah. It's really unique and special.
It's unique. It's very unique, and it's not very common, but it happens.
Yeah, but when you first encountered Scorsese, and this was Raging Bull, what were your impressions of him?
Well, let me give you the whole history of that. I was called. I had an agent. I went to see an agent at that. No, I didn't have an agent. Oh, I had seen Joe. Joe was already asked about playing Joey LaMotta, Joe and I weren't playing together at this time, but I ran. He said, "They got a role called Salvia. You should come up and see." And blah 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 blah. So I made a date to go up and see Chris. I forgot her name. She was the casting director, and she gave me the sides, and she said, "Look at these sides, and you'll audition." And I had to go up to Park Avenue, up to a suite in a hotel. And I knocked at the door, and a PA answered the door, and I walked in, and Bob was standing there. And I had not met Bob prior to this. He said, "Hi, I'm Bob De Niro. I liked your work in Death Collector." I said, "I'm Frank Vincent, and I liked your work in Deer Hunter." So we and Joe was there, and Marty was there, and they had a PA with a camera, and Joe and I did the scene that we did in The Raging Bull from the street. When we were walking in the street, we did that audition in the hotel, and Sis Corman was her name. And then I was leaving for Las Vegas a week later for a vacation, and I got a call 2 days later to come in and do a screen test. But I had an Afro haircut, and I had a big black mustache.
Yeah.
And they said, "We're going to cut your hair, and we're going to cut the mustache off." And I said, "Okay." So I got up 2 days later. I went to the audition, and they dressed us in the clothes, and we got dressed in the period, and we went on the set, and we did the scene from the Copa when Joe hits me with the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that scene for an audition. And Frank Adonis, who played my right-hand guy, also auditioned for the role of Salvi. But Joe and I had the magic, and it worked. That's what brought it together. I left for Las Vegas 2 days later, and I called from the desert. I called Sis Corman. She said, "You got the role." So
wow.
I don't even know what that meant at that point. So I called an agent, and he booked it, and whatever. And that's the beginning of what it was. And I hope I answered your question.
No, that was great. But also Scorsese, when you first encountered him, what did you think of him?
He's not a very domineering character. He's a very small guy,
mm-hmm.
and he's very, very friendly, and he laughs a lot, and he's not intimidating at all. I don't get intimidated by anybody anyway. I mean, when you play nightclubs for 20 years, you know, people take out guns and stuff, and they
mm-hmm.
do a lot of crazy shit in the nightclub.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I really didn't, you know, Martin Scorsese was Martin Scorsese at that time. He wasn't who Martin Scorsese is today.
Right.
You know, he just came off Taxi. I don't even know if he did Taxi at that point, but I know he did the other one.
Taxi was 76, one of the best movies of the 70s,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so we did, this was 79, so he already done Taxi. I probably saw it, but I still wasn't, you know, a Scorsese.
Right.
You know, until, you know, now. I mean, you have to, whatever. So I wasn't really intimidated. De Niro, I'd seen Death Clare, I'd seen Deer Hunter, and I knew who Bob was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I wasn't an actor. I was a musician. So, I, you know, these people were just people to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And,
did you find that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Did you find that it came easy for you, though, the acting process?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm, like I said, I'm not so intimidatable, and I'm pretty confident. I mean, I really do homework.
Right.
And I when I did the first movie that I did, I didn't have to work on this. I didn't have to work till 5 weeks into the shoot, and I was there every day, sitting on the set, just to learn the language and learn what a camera was, and I took up photography on my own. With a still lens, and I learned about you know, camera and stuff on my own, just to get a little knowledge of it. So I mean, I learned it, yeah, and I'm a pretty quick learner.
Yeah,
I was anyway when I was a younger guy.
But you've worked with Scorsese several times, and you've worked with our best directors. I mean, I'm crazy about Spike Lee and Scorsese and all these guys. What's unique and special about Scorsese and the way he directs you?
Okay. Marty is, again, he's a low-key guy, and he'll say to you, "I got an idea. Let's try this or let's try that." And he'll ask you, "What do you think of this or what do you think of that? Let's try this or we'll do this." And he gives you the opportunity to fly, and he gives you the opportunity to use some of your own juice in the scene. And better if you stood on this side and approached him from that side for the camera, because technically he really knows what he's talking about, and that and the technical aspect of it escapes you as an actor, because you're not going to know what he knows. You know, he knows a lot about what he's talking about.
Right.
So mostly he puts you into the mode of the emotion of the character and whatever. And he gives you the opportunity to fly, and that's unique about Marty. And then when you try something and he doesn't like it, he says, "That was terrific, but you know what? Let's try it this way."
Yeah.
So he never says, "No, I didn't like that too much," you know.
Yeah.
So he's polite about it.
He's encouraging.
Most good directors do that anyway.
Right.
I mean, that's a way of handling talent.
Okay.
But when you read a Goodfellas or a Casino, and when you're on the set, and obviously his camera work is amazing as well, there's such an energy to his stuff. Can you feel that energy?
No. You have, when you're an actor and you're on the set and they're taking pictures of you, you don't know what the camera's doing. I mean, you know how to stay in the camera, and you know where the camera is going and where you've got to meet the camera, but you don't see the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't see the picture until after it's all put together. At least I don't, anyway, because, I mean, now they're working. I mean, he did Raging Bull without a monitor. I mean, now they all use monitors, and he's got a real big one, you know. So now they look at the scene after they shoot it. They didn't do that before. It's like photography now. They all shoot on digital, and the photographers now take a shot, they look at it, take a shot, they look at it. Years ago, they just banged away. You know, they just shoot 36, put another roll in, shoot another 36. So you don't have a sense of what the camera's seeing because you have no idea how they're going to put it together. You have no idea what he's keeping. You have no idea. I mean, you have a vague idea, but you really don't know until you see what they did. And as far as the editing is concerned,
right?
So after you acted in it, it's all over for you. You know what I mean?
But this is interesting to me because essentially, I mean, Goodfellas and especially Casino for me, they're such kind of broad canvases. And as an actor or as a techie on the film, you're like a stitch in that fabric. And so when you sit back and you watch the final product of Goodfellas or Casino, does it surprise you?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. To this day, it surprises me.
Yeah.
I don't watch it a lot. I mean, I've only seen Casino probably two times or three times that I run into it by accident. Mm-hmm. I never just put it on and say, let me watch this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm amazed. I'm amazed at some of the work. I mean, Marty's, it's amazing how brilliant he is.
With Goodfellas and Casino and these kinds of roles, the roles that you're offered a lot, the tough guys, the mafiosos, did you know any of those guys growing up? Did you base it on any of those guys, real life?
Well, what you do, I mean, by playing in all the clubs that I played and the era that I played in, the clubs were owned by these guys, and these guys ran the nightclubs.
Mm.
So you saw them in their natural habitat. You know, I mean, you saw them. They used to have card games, and after they closed the club down, they would have card games, and you'd sit around drinking, and it's full of wise guys, all wise guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you see how they talk, how they walk, how they act, how they dress, how they treat women. So you get a real firsthand knowledge of that. And Joe's the same thing. There's a couple of characters that he's played that we could say we knew who that guy really was. You know what I mean? Because he had the lead. He had more of a lead on it than I did. So, but you learn this from just being around it. I've been in nightclubs since I'm 18 years old, and they used to have card games in the taxi stand next to $1,000 a card. I was amazed.
Right.
You know, I'm 18 years old. They're shooting crap, and I'm, you know, these guys have been around. So. That rubs off when you see it. You learn the language. You learn how to.
That's why your performances are so authentic. I mean, they're the real deal.
Well, it comes from the real deal. I'm really not that. I mean, I'm quite different than that is.
No, I realize that.
You are.
It rubs off as a good. You obviously, like a lot of people. Sadly, we live in an era, at least my generation, where it's just the imitation of the imitation of the imitation.
Yes, exactly.
You really studied this because each time out, what I'm amazed at is you keep it fresh and different each performance. No one could ever accuse you of, how should we say it, doing a Xerox of a previous performance. It's new and different every time.
That's good. Yep.
Well, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah.
Differentiating all of these.
Well, I think that the whole secret is in what the writing gives you. The writing has to be what it is, and when you have language that's coming out of your mouth that is so beautiful and poetic, you can do a lot with it in terms of and if you look at it really and define it, that's probably the distinct feature of it. I mean, Phil Leotardo had some. I mean, he was singing music when he spoke. You know, I mean, that's the stuff that David wrote. You know, they renamed my name, which Leotardo. We were named after a ballet skirt. You know,
right?
I mean, you know, you know, some of the stuff. The writing is what gets me mostly and inspires me to find the niche of that character. You know, some guys are real. Hey, are you going to go over there or what? You know what I mean? So then
right.
There's gangsters and lawyers and doctors and politicians, you know. So a gangster's a gangster. And I don't know, everybody's different. So you got to find a little difference in each person. That's all. That's what you do.
But your character in Casino too is based on someone.
It's based
in real
life. Frank Collado, right?
Yes, who was personally on the set every day.
He was.
Wow.
Okay.
Yes. And he showed me how to take the safe out. And an interesting story about Frank Collado is that Joe played the Spilatro.
Right.
Joe played Spilatro, and Spilatro's guy. Obviously, Spilatro was dead, but his guy was in Vegas. His boss or his mentor or somebody, and he would come to the set occasionally, and every time he came to the set, Frank had to leave the set because Frank was in a witness protection.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did he manage this?
And he left the witness protection program because he wasn't afraid anymore. And he told me stories about how he bombed guys' cars and the different murders that he committed. And once in a while, we would communicate by van from the set to our trailers or whatever. They would pick us up in the van, and we'd go like four or five blocks, whatever. And Frank would say sometimes, "Why don't you come? I'll give you a ride over." So we would lift up the hood, look under the car, make sure there was no bombs,
right?
Because he was a marked guy.
Yeah. How did they? Yeah, I mean, because also Henry Hill lately, I've noticed, since he's writing these books and he has his artwork and the cookbook, he's come out of hiding too.
Well, they got—they have what we call balls.
That's those titanium steel balls. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of the argument with Casino as compared to Goodfellas, but Scorsese himself has even said that he was kind of thrown over the coals over Casino. Because people unfairly compared it to Goodfellas. For me, and Jerry both, we've discussed this a lot, it's kind of like The Godfather and The Godfather 2. The Godfather, like Goodfellas, is a perfect movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Casino, like Godfather 2, feels somehow a lot more richer and more ambitious. And that's why I constantly go back to Casino. I'm wondering what your take is on that comparison between Casino and Goodfellas.
Well, I think what you're seeing is the difference between a film shot in the era of Goodfellas in New York and a film shot in the beautiful desert of Las Vegas.
Right.
You have a visual element that's involved. Goodfellas is grittier.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more of a period than I don't know if the periods are the same. They might be close to each other.
They're close to each other, but...
Because that was New York in its heyday, and mm-hmm. that's when all the guys, like I said, they owned the clubs, and that's when they did the Lufthansa robbery, and that was, what, in the 60s, late 60s? Or I'm not
right.
sure.
Right, late 60s, early 70s, I believe.
So now our Casino was in, like, the 80s?
The 70s and 80s, I believe.
Yeah, so you're seeing it, and he did that on purpose, I'm sure. Because just the visuality of it, of Casino, is brilliant. It's
mm-hmm.
wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the scene of Joe and him in the desert when the car pulls up
mm-hmm.
through the eyeglasses, I mean, it's amazing. And then you say, you know, the Goodfellas, when he was walking in the Copa with that Steadicam shot that took
forever. That's a great shot.
So, I mean, that's Scorsese's his niche.
Yeah.
And you can't compare the two movies. I mean,
no, thank
just
you.
Because they're about gangsters.
Well, that shows you the lack of creativity on these people's parts. They just want to tear something down. But I mean, the only similarity I can really think of between the two movies, forget the gangsters, that's just silly, but is that maybe like the drugs, when the characters get into drugs, it shows their downfall. That's the only similarity I could honestly point to.
But that's the reality of what it was. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you know, you think about Godfather 1 and Godfather 2, and personally, I like Godfather 2 better than 1. But
me too.
I think I was going to say they're fictitious stories. I mean, they're not. They're based.
They're fairy tales.
Yeah, they're fairy tales. You know, and to Scorsese's triad is facts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had to go to Chicago to shoot my movie that's coming out very soon, and I was in Chicago, and somebody in the crew said there's a great little restaurant you should go. La la la. I went. And I'm sitting with my wife in this little neighborhood restaurant. It's owned by an elderly Italian woman. And I say elderly, maybe in her 70s, and she's very, very handsomely dressed. She comes to my table. She says to me, you know, that was a terrible thing you did to those boys in that ditch. She said, you know, I knew their wives, and they suffered tremendously for what you did to them. Now, this is a grown-up woman talking about the Spalatros that we put
right.
in the grave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
wow.
I mean, that's how much reality there is in that.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's what we loved about Goodfellas when it came out. It was sort of like it was billed as the anti-Godfather.
Yeah.
When it came out.
It wasn't romanticized
as
much.
No, it's really funny though. Godfather, I mean, Goodfellas has become over time romanticized. I've noticed
yes.
the same way the Godfather had.
Yeah, it always does that. Somebody said to me about Goodfellas. This is a school teacher. Another story. She said when they went in the house to eat. Bob and Joe and Henry Hill, and they went in to eat, and that was Marty's mother, by the way. I'm sure you
mm-hmm.
know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she said, when they were in the house and eating, how could you breathe in the trunk? Now that's the same thing as the woman said about the Spalatro.
Yeah. That never ceases to amaze me.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Educated woman. This is a woman that's a school teacher. You know?
Right. Right.
I want to ask you about one more scene in Casino, and then I want to hear what you're up to now. But the beating scene, obviously you took quite a beating from Pesci in Goodfellas, but you got to return the favor in Casino. When you're shooting a scene like that, tell me about that, what the atmosphere is like on that set.
Okay, first of all, that was a Hollywood ending. You know, that wasn't the real reality of the story.
Mm-hmm.
They were put in a grave. They were buried alive, but
mm-hmm.
not by Frank Culotta.
Okay.
Not by my character.
Okay.
Because Frank Culotta told me that he never loved anybody. It was never as close to anybody as he was to Spalatro.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Spalatro was his brother, like.
Mm-hmm.
So he says he didn't do that murder. He didn't kill them, but they were killed. Okay. Now, we have to do this scene. First of all, the corn cannot grow in Las Vegas, okay, because the weather's too hot. So
right.
they had to make a cornfield, which they did on big long rods on the ground. They stuck corn stalks in them, which were movable. They could move like six rods and make a space, so you could have space to put a camera, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it was about 35, 40 degrees. It was freezing in the desert, and we had heaters. Now, when we get out of the car, I have to hit him with the bat, and the bat is a gimmick bat. You can't follow through with it. You have to just hit it and get off it right away,
mm-hmm.
otherwise it'll bend. And we did that stuff, and then we have to rehearse the stuff with his brother where I hit him with the bat. And then we have the hole, and we have to find somebody to double Joe to throw them in the hole, because if they have a dummy... A part of that is a dummy, a pneumatic dummy that they use that looks like Joe. When
mm-hmm.
you see the dirt hit them in the face, you see the puff of dirt fly out. That's a dummy. So they got a production assistant that looked like Joe, and they used him, and they undressed him, and then we threw him in the grave. And the shot of me hitting Joe is Joe's lying under the camera, and I'm looking at him. And he says, no, Frankie, no, whatever he says. And I just swing the bat, and it's cut.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's really all effects. And I said to Marty, I said, what's the story? You know, I mean, what is he thinking about when he does this? He says, well, this is the end of the road for you and your friend, he says. And it's all over, and this is the parting shot that you have to give him. And people have told me that shot is that they can't even watch it.
It's a hard
it's
thing
brutal.
To watch. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, brutal is putting being kind about it. It's just
yeah.
impossible to watch.
Yeah.
Was there ever a thought that, because I read, it was probably a rumor that Scorsese directed more violence than he anticipated on finally using. So if they gave him a rating that was harsher than R, he could cut out the stuff that he didn't want in the first place and get his R.
Yeah, because of the R, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like, you know, we might be going too far here?
Well, you like I said, you don't know, you know, you don't know what they're going to keep, so you have to always do more. So they have enough that they can edit something and make it work.
Yeah.
So when we squashed the guy's head in the vice, I mean,
yeah,
that kid was on the floor all day. I mean, you know, 18 times we had to take it.
I was just curious. Speaking of the violence in the film, because it is very violent. For you at that time, did that feel like the most violent film that you had been in at the time?
Well, you know, you're looking at it as an observer. I'm looking at it as somebody's doing it. No, I don't have those kind of thoughts. I don't.
Okay.
Think that.
I was just curious.
I mean, when I beat up Annabella Shara in Duke Jungle Fever, I thought that was pretty violent.
That's definitely.
I mean, the things I had to say to her were very, very bad. And then Spike said, "Yeah, you okay with this?" I said, "Yeah, I'm okay with it." And when I auditioned for him. And he has a totally black crew. I mean, 80-90% black. The things he had to say to her, and that's pretty violent to me.
Yeah, that is.
I love that movie, by the way, too.
Great film.
I love Spike Lee, and I can see parallels where somebody like a Spike Lee took a lot from Scorsese.
Absolutely.
I can see that. Yeah. Well, how do you see those similarities between the two?
Oh yeah, Spike is a. You look at his shots, and you can call them all the shots. He's got a signature shot that he does that is like, it's pretty silly. They get on the camera dolly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
You're
yeah.
walking, and the camera's static on the characters, but you see the scenery moving.
Yeah,
like, I don't know where he got that from. That's a pretty silly shot. But you look at all the rest of the shots, and they're very, very Scorsese-ish because he grew up with Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who are you gonna copy and I think all directors copy the main guys. I mean, it's not very much that hasn't been done before, except for all these crazy Transformer things. You know, I mean, all these kind of things. You know, that's not even film. That's just, you know.
Yeah, that's a video game.
That's a video game, exactly.
But you might as well copy from the best.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Copy from Scorsese.
Scarface, what's his name, the director?
De Palma.
I don't think he copied from Scorsese so much. I mean,
he copied from Hitchcock.
Yeah. And what's his name in California, you know, the big guy. I mean, he's pretty original with the stuff. I can't remember their names. So you know what I'm talking about.
Which film?
Spielberg?
Spielberg, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They all came up together.
Right.
And,
yeah, we've had De Palma and Paul Schrader on the show, and so we're insane.
Yeah, we drop on Mr. De Palma without a doubt. No, but
Schrader's a funny guy.
Oh, yes, he is.
You can tell he's a writer because he speaks so eloquently and brings up such colorful, interesting points. He was wonderful.
But there is I just want to go back.
I want to give you a Schrader story. Remind me. Okay, go ahead.
Please, yes.
Yeah, please. If you got a Schrader story, go for it.
All right. When we were doing Raging Bull, and Salvi was in the car, Tommy was banging his head against the door. You know, Paul Schrader's in that scene. And he's standing on the sidewalk, and he comes out in left field with nothing. He says, "They're animals. They're fucking animals, these people. Who are these people?" He had Marty on the floor because that wasn't in any, written anyway. He just went off, and he did that. And that's reminded me of Paul Schrader.
Wow. Anyway. Jerry, you had one more question.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring in. It was just an observation when Casino came out and I'm reading interviews with Mr. Scorsese. But he had said in one interview, and I think it was a younger publication, a younger interview, because he was getting egged on about Tarantino at the time, because this was right after, like a year or two after Pulp Fiction came out. Mm-hmm. And Scorsese gave an answer that I think is classic. He goes, "Look, I made this movie, but one of the reasons I made this movie is to say I do this better than anyone else alive."
Mm-hmm.
And it was like to prove a point. I was just curious if you ever got that feeling on the set that he had something to prove, because I didn't ever get that feeling about him.
No, I don't. I mean, if he has that feeling, he's keeping it to himself.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, Tarantino's Tarantino. It's,
he is.
Guys are different. Ball players are different than each other. And they hit home runs and they get strikeouts, and it's like anything else. I mean, Marty's brilliant.
He is. You know, there's no one like him.
No, and he should have got an Academy Award prior, much sooner than he got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Jack Nicholson, the fact that he directed him and the Hollywood bullshit.
He should have had 7 Academy Awards.
Oh, yeah,
already.
Exactly,
he
right.
should have had so many.
Yeah.
I mean, he's made the best movies of every decade he's worked in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And he's really proud to be part of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me what's coming up before I let you go for you.
We have a film called Chicago Overcoat. If you go on my website, frankvincent.com, and my current projects page, you can see a trailer of it. It's really good.
He's got a fellow we just interviewed Armand Asante a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, Armand's in the movie with me,
Yeah.
Did he talk about it?
He mentioned it,
but not in detail, though. He also worked with Stacey Keats. It's got a great cast.
Stacey and Mike Starr
and
Catherine Narducci. And I'm playing the lead of the movie, playing Over the Hill Hitman.
But I like when you play the lead, and I also like this other movie you made earlier part of this decade, This Thing of Ours, which I thought was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. This Thing
I
of
love
Ours,
that film.
Danny Provenzano, right.
Yes.
I just got off the phone with him prior to talking to you.
Oh, wow.
We got another project called Manhattan, Kansas. We're going to be shooting something. I think we're going to shoot a pilot maybe in September. It looks like it's happening. But I want to talk about Chicago Overcoat. We're going to some festivals now. In October, we're going to Lauderdale, we're going to Chicago, they probably premiere it in Chicago, and we're going to the Illinois Festival, then looking at Sarasota. And
Sarasota, that's my neck of the woods, Sarasota.
You're going to meet with him,
You know Jody, Kobasa from the festival?
Yes, I do, yes.
He's the executive director, good man.
Yeah,
yes he is.
So Chicago Overcoat will be coming out soon, you keep looking out for that, and I have also on my website, I have my Marblehead doll. And you say, what's a Marblehead doll? This is a Billy Bats. And if you press the button, he says, go home and get your shine box.
He says,
nobody's breaking up my party, and give those Irish hoodlums a drink.
That is beautiful.
And he's a bobblehead, but we call him a Marblehead.
Okay, that was Frank Vincent talking about Casino and Scorsese and his Marbleheads.
Well, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better interview. I mean, he was just chock full of information. He was just
patriot
about it.
Man, what a colorful guy that's led quite a life. You know, it's funny to me because the screen personas that we've talked to, at least among those that we've talked to, like the Frank Vincents and Armand Asantes and
Robert Davi.
The tough guys. That you expect a certain thing from them. They're the nicest, sweetest, most kind of giving people in an interview.
Yeah, they are.
And, you know, I wonder if it works the reverse way. I wonder if Tom Hanks is an asshole.
I don't want to find out the hard way, but yeah.
Great guy. Frank Vincent talking about Casino. There's some talk in the chat room. There's some dissension. And about the performances in the movie. And I just wanted to give lip service to this because there's a lot of dissension about Casino.
Right.
So it's nothing unique necessarily. But one of the big performances and one of the big discoveries that came out of the film was the fact that Sharon Stone could really act.
It was like that first and last time, though. I mean,
And I equate it with opportunity. You know, there's.
Mm-hmm.
I just brought up Tom Hanks. Would we have thought Tom Hanks was capable of the stuff he's done when he was doing, you know, otherwise funny movies like The Man with One Red Shoe and all of that kind of stuff.
Or Splash or Bachelor Party,
yeah.
I mean,
it's all about opportunity. And Scorsese gave Sharon Stone an opportunity. And I think she soared in it.
She did, and the sad thing is that she never did after that. That's the sad thing about that film. I'll give her the benefit of the doubt with Total Recall and Basic Instinct, but she just... Casino was this once-in-a-lifetime chance, and sadly, she never was able to capitalize off of it.
Right. And the relationship between she and De Niro in the film is unique in that she's her own type of hustler. I mean, she's a mover and a shaker in Vegas. She survives on her wits. And here's Sam Rothstein that thinks that she's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen, wants to start a relationship with her, but she doesn't love him. She never does love him. And I wanted to play this clip
of when he first proposes mm-hmm. marriage, and it being Ginger, which is the character Sharon Stone plays,
right.
the proposal plays almost more like a business proposition.
That's true.
Yeah, here's that scene.
We're not getting any younger. Don't you think it's time? Aren't you getting tired of all this shit? Banging around, hustling around.
What, are you trying to handicap me?
I'm going to do you one better. I'm trying to marry you. You want to marry me? I'm serious. Yeah, I want to settle down. I want a family.
You got the wrong girl, Sam.
I know I'd be a good father. I know you'd be a good mother.
You don't know me. What do you know me just 3 months? What do you know?
I'm 43 years old. I don't want to wait. I know you well enough to know that I really love you very much. And I can't think of anybody better to be with. And I don't feel like waiting anymore.
You know, a lot of happily married people, Sam, because I don't.
Yeah, I know all that.
I care about you. But I just don't have those kind of feelings for you. I'm not in love with you.
I
understand. Sorry.
No, I mean, that can grow. As long as there's a mutual respect, that kind of thing can grow. I'm realistic. I can accept that. You know, what is love anyway? It's a mutual respect. It's a devotion. It's a caring from one person to another. And if we could set up some kind of foundation based on that mutual respect, I feel that eventually you would care enough about me that I can live with that.
If it doesn't work out, you know, if it doesn't play out, then what happens to me?
You know, I'm doing well now. And I'm going to do even better. And so whatever happens, if it doesn't work out between us, I'm going to make sure you're okay for the rest of your life. And if there are kids, especially, you know, I'll take care of you better than you'd ever imagine.
What are you pitching me?
Just what I said. You'll be set up for the rest of your life. That I can promise you. Want to take a chance?
Casino, the anti-love story.
No, that's a good. That's a really good scene, though. A really great scene.
Yeah, it is. And she obviously goes far downhill.
Oh, she does. But I think, you know, it is really, you know, I know you're not a big fan of the film, and, you know, history has not been, time has not been kind of Basic Instinct, or for that matter, Total Recall, but she did excel at those roles. But Scorsese will be the one director who gave her the benefit of the doubt, and she did take it, and she won.
And I actually, and they, when I just said she went downhill, I meant her character. But
His character. But you know, she was never given the opportunity.
Yeah.
To really, you know, the remake of Diabolique and what was it, One Last Dance or whatever.
Right.
These movies weren't really. They never really showcased what she was capable of. I think Scorsese was the one director when, if her biography is to be written, really gave her the benefit of the doubt, and she went for it.
It does bring up an interesting conversation about Scorsese, though, and his depiction of women. Because if there's been one through line to the criticisms of Scorsese throughout the years, and I think somebody like Camille Paglia
mm-hmm.
Generated a lot of type on this, it is his depiction of women. And I think that you look at a Casino, or you look at the beginning of his career, like an Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore,
mm-hmm.
and you see that that's not a problem for him. You look at An Age of Innocence.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just he chooses genres that, for the most part, are male-driven, are very masculine.
Well, yeah, that's very true, but he does manage to, even in the last film, The Departed, he does give Vera Farmiga one of her best parts before she becomes typecast in her Lee Remick phase as the mother of troubled children.
Yeah.
And that's true in the three films that followed that. I mean, he does give actresses some of their best parts. Michelle Pfeiffer, The Age of Innocence, Sharon Stone, Casino, Lorraine Bracco, Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm going to be very honest here. I mean, Lorraine Bracco is excellent there, and is not really that good again till The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's just a personal opinion. I realize many people might disagree with that, but...
Yeah, which, of course, we forgot to mention Frank Vincent's inclusion in The Sopranos as well.
I mean, Phil Leotardo. I mean, I'm going to tell you, kids, I was scared to talk to him. I was really afraid that his fist would come through the phone. I was very nervous. I called Jamie the night before. I'm really scared to talk to this guy.
That's true. And so we did try to get Joe Pesci for the show, and I contacted his publicist, and she said, yes, I do represent him, and he never does interviews. He never does interviews, which is interesting that he has a publicist.
Yeah, I know, but he doesn't do anything. No, but I will say this about Joe Pesci. When he did come back for that one scene in The Good Shepherd,
mm-hmm.
I think everyone on this show or all of our guests on this show will agree that he does. I like that film a lot. I realize I'm in that 1% that likes the film, but it's his that one scene he's brilliant in, and it reminds
yeah.
us of why we like him in this film and Goodfellas and Raising Bull. And it's a shame that he doesn't act more often because he's an excellent actor.
Yeah, and which brings me to a scene I want to play of Pesci in Casino.
Okay.
We've talked about how Casino has more of everything. It kind of builds more of everything from the Goodfellas. And that includes the language.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of which Pesci is the record holder in this film. And it has one of the all-time great confrontations between he and De Niro in the desert. Frank
mm-hmm.
Vincent alluded to it. And it's a brilliant back and forth. Here's that scene.
Okay.
Where the fuck you get off talking to people about me behind my back going over my head?
What people?
What people would you think I wasn't going to find out?
I don't even know what you're talking about, Nick.
No? You said I'm bringing heat on you? I got to listen to people because of your fucking shit? You're ordering me out? You better get your own fucking army, pal.
I didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't order you or anybody. I only told Andy Stone that you had a lot of heat on you and that was a problem.
You want me to get out of my own fucking town?
Yeah, I said let the bullshit blow over for a while so I can run the casino. Anything goes wrong with the casino, it's my ass. It's not yours, it's my ass.
I don't know whether you notice or not, but you only have your fucking casino because I made that possible. I'm what counts out here. Not your fucking country clubs or your fucking TV shows. And what the fuck are you doing on TV anyhow? You know, I get calls from back home every fucking day. They think you went batshit.
I'm only on TV because I got to be able to hang around a casino. You understand that.
Your
you know that. Come on.
Fucking ass. You could have had the food and beverage job without going on television. You wanted to go on TV.
Yeah, I did want to go on TV. That way I have a forum. I can fight back. I'm known. People see me. They know they can't fuck around with me like they could if I was an unknown. That's right,
you're making
yeah.
a big fucking spectacle of yourself.
Me? I wouldn't even be in this situation if it wasn't for you. You brought down so much fucking heat on me. I mean, every time I meet somebody here, the big question is, do I know you?
Oh, sure.
And
now you want to bring your fucking license on me.
No,
right?
Nicky, when you asked me if you could come out here, what did I tell you? I mean, you asked me, and I knew you were going to come out no matter what I said, but what did I tell you? Do you remember what I told you?
Back
do you remember
back
what
up
I told
a fucking
you?
Minute here. 1 minute. I asked you, when the fuck did I ever ask you if I could come out here? Get this through your head,
you never...
Get this through your head, you Jew motherfucker, you. You only exist out here because of me. That's the only reason. Without me, you, personally, every fucking wise guy still around will take a piece of your fucking Jew ass. That way you're gonna go. Your fucking warrant don't ever go over my fucking head again, you motherfucker, you.
Wow.
That, yeah.
I'm sorry, I should have given a parental guidance warning.
Oh,
prior
you don't
to that
need
clip.
To do that. Everyone
yeah.
knows that we're very passionate about.
Man, what a conversation. He's a firecracker. That high-pitched voice, the small frame, and yet you know that he's a mercenary, man. You know
oh,
that
he
he's
is.
Just, oh, he's great in that movie. Scorsese, I found a clip of Scorsese actually talking about why he wanted to do this movie. And in previous interviews, when you get to Casino,
mm-hmm.
he always kind of shakes his head and says, man, I was crucified for Casino for the reasons that we've spoken about. So
it's a very ambitious project. I know that he's very proud of it, but at the same time a little bewildered of the reaction that he got from it. And I looked through some of the previous reviews of it that were released upon the film's release, and they all echoed about the same thing. There are a few that were glowing, and then there are a few that said, you know, it's just nothing new here. There's no substance here. It's all flash, which couldn't be farther from the truth. But
yeah, I mean, it really couldn't.
But here's why he chose to do Casino.
What it was the unbelievable strangeness that something as cliche as the brains of an operation falling for a woman. The only mistake he ever makes in his life is falling for a certain kind of woman. Not that she was bad, but he set up a situation that he knew he couldn't win in. And that woman having a relationship with his best friend, who is the brawn, the muscle of the operation. And then you place that against the background of Vegas, and you place Vegas representing America at the time, and the idea of no limit. There's no limit. You know, you want money? How much? You want to make money? Just keep making money. Make it billions. You want drugs? Keep taking drugs until you blow your brains out. You know, drinking, women, and there's no limits. There's no limits. In the 80s in America, there were no limits. People came in, robber barons, basically, came in, didn't give anything back to the country, didn't give anything back to the society, just took the money and ran. And this is what the same thing these people were doing. So how could you look and condemn them? At least they were honest about it. You know, so that's what fascinated me about making that world, you know, and creating that world, and creating a world where there are no limits. What do you become as a human being? I mean, the character De Niro plays likes to play with his brain. You know, he has those figures in his head. He's a genius with figures, you know, and yet he falls hard.
Yeah, he really does.
He does.
And it speaks to the tone of his movie, too, and the breakneck pace and the intoxicating style of it, where it's an overwhelming experience. It's just a lot of sensory experience coming at you over a three-hour time period.
Mm-hmm.
And that speaks to the kind of wild abandon of the lives he's portraying in the movie, too.
Absolutely.
And very bold. Like I recall the opening credit sequence, the Saul Bass credit sequence, where the car explodes and De Niro's floating midair against the Vegas lights and the red Vegas lights, and it's like his descension into hell, which is a concept that he took, and Saul Bass realized it very boldly, and that's the first note of the film.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Let's bring on Aaron. He can give a few thoughts about Casino as well with us. And then we're going to move on to another topic to close out the show. Aaron, hey.
Hey, what's up, fellas?
Hey, how you doing, Aaron?
I'm good.
What's up, good fellas?
Nothing wrong. Hey, well, the thing about Casino, from my mind, well, first of all, I remember when it came out, that Thanksgiving holiday weekend. I'm sure, Jamie, I'm sure you were still in theaters when it came out that holiday.
Yeah.
You didn't think Money Train was the big hit of the weekend?
No, I was like, I knew it was going to be Casino, and we're opening up, just a personal anecdote, we're opening up a brand new theater, and it was a big VIP event, and we were going to screen Casino. And I remember I had to put Casino together, put the film together.
Right, right.
And the CEO of the company walked up, this was AMC, and said, you know, my wife met Marty.
There you go.
So this is a big deal for her to watch this movie tonight. And I was like, oh, God, please don't let me screw up putting this print together.
It was
flawless, of course.
It was Casino, Money Train, Nick of Time.
That's right. Good memory there.
Nick of Time. And Casino did well. I remember of those three films, I think Casino did well. I do remember, but of course it was being overshadowed by Toy Story.
Oh, everything was at that time being overshadowed by Toy Story.
But I saw
Casino especially did well for a three-hour film.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's very true.
I saw Casino twice, I think, within 1 week. Because Scorsese, that's what drew me into film criticism.
Right.
And what I find interesting, and I was talking to a friend, and the way I've always looked at Casino, that if you take Mean Streets, Goodfellas and Casino, his unofficial mob trilogy, the way I look at it, it represents the three strata of society, and that Mean Street is kind of the low-income, you know, borderline impoverished community. Goodfellas is a total, you know, working-class story.
Mm-hmm.
And then Casino is about the CEOs and the management.
Yeah.
In it. And to look at those three films as this kind of, and you can throw in Gangs of New York as kind of a wraparound where it's
mm-hmm.
Where it sows the seeds of, you know, of capitalism and tribalism in America.
That's true.
Really,
that's a good point.
Really, these three films, Mean Streets, Goodfellas, and Casino, what Scorsese's been doing, he's been using these mafia stories, these Mean Street stories, to basically tell the three different stories of the class system in America. And that's what I've always admired about these films.
Mm-hmm.
And it is kind of, you know, at that time, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, Casino came out, I think, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks before Nixon. And
mm-hmm, that's true, yeah.
And what I found interesting is that, you know, and Scorsese was a student teacher at NYU with Oliver Stone, and that if you look at the editing that Schoonmaker does in Casino and look at the peak of Oliver Stone's editing in Natural Born Killers and then Nixon, that there really is, you know, those, you look at Casino and Nixon, those two films, in a weird way, they're totally different, but in a real way, they're talking to each other, and it's kind of it's tangents. Nixon, you know, Nixon is a film, it's a life story, but it's all about the tangents that tell that life story, and it's non-linear structure. And Casino, while it's not as wild as Nixon in its story structure, but it also goes into tangents. It has this breakneck pace, Casino, but it also has these moments where it ebbs and flows and it kind of calms down. I remember the sequence after they kill the guy's head in the vice. Well,
right.
That's like a crescendo, and the film literally has to take a breath, and we get a little 15-20 minute section there involving Sharon Stone and James Woods, but the pacing has slowed down, and it's almost like a breather, but stuff is still happening. And the
film, yeah, a little bit.
It ebbs and flows that way, and that's what I find remarkable. Nixon does that too. There's the part where, you know, Nixon's getting elected, and then it kind of slows down, and then there's bombing of Cambodia, and then it slows down.
Well, it's got to have contrast. I mean, for any movie to be effective dramatically, they have to have contrast.
Right.
Even JFK, which we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
there's still the quiet moments where he's reflecting and he's talking to his wife and
mm-hmm.
self-doubt, and when he kicks the guy off of his team because he doesn't believe in the cause, and it's good direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's being a good dramatist.
That's a good point, Jamie.
But your point is very well taken about the companion pieces in Scorsese's career and how they complement each other and they grow on a theme.
And
he
pretty much said, he got hammered by the violence in Casino, and you could tell by that last aria of the House of the Rising Sun sequence and then the baseball bat sequence that Scorsese, at least for a while, at least up until Departed, which is almost like a decade later, over a decade, 11 years later, that he was done with violence. He'd done a lot of, be it Mean Streets, be it Raging Bull, be it Goodfellas, be it Cape Fear, and then Casino. He'd done a lot of violent set pieces and really, you know, and didn't sugarcoat it and didn't do it for laughs. And you could tell, you know what, I've done all I can with violence in Casino. I'm going to take a break.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, Kundun, Bringing Out the Dead, and he got a little more meditative. Aviator, which is, in my mind, his most autobiographical film. But then, you know, and he was, you know, he took a breather, and then we come back with Departed, which is kind of, he comes, you know, out with, you know, guns blazing again.
And yet, if you interview him, he'll say that he feels that a movie like Age of Innocence is his most violent.
Yeah.
And then you watch Age of Innocence, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Socially, it is. I mean, yeah.
Well, and the thing about gangs, if you look at gangs in New York, that isn't he's talked about gangs in New York. There is violence in gangs of New York. The big opening scene and then the big closing scene and a couple of little altercations. But the editing in Gangs of New York is so precise in that he's really doing tricks with your eyes, and that there's not a lot of blood in Gangs in New York. It's all about the before and after.
I agree with all that, Aaron. Don't you think that Gangs of New York, right down to its title credits, is in some ways his homage to Sergio Leone?
Well, I mean, that's obvious. I mean, he's quoting it. Well, he's
quoting it in a lot of scenes, too. Now, I'm just not talking about the credit sequence, but that was a big year for Leone Renaissance.
Right.
2 years, actually. And what I couldn't get over was just the way it was very structured, like Once Upon a Time in the West. And I mean that in the highest compliment I can give a film. And to someone of that stature who doesn't need to do a homage to Leone, but he still chose to.
I think I've always liked Gangs of New York, but he had the Gangs of New York in his mind for so many years.
I think he had it since Mean Streets.
Yeah.
And so however he conceived it, I think was pretty much set in stone years before he actually got to do it.
Mm.
But if you talk about paying homage to different films, different filmmakers, which is an accusation thrown against Tarantino a lot, and it's a hard accusation to ignore, I don't think of it as a negative.
It's not a negative.
Yeah, Scorsese is the same way. I was telling my girl last night, thank you for that chuckle, Aaron.
The
thing is, on this show, Movie Geeks United, it has to be, I was talking to my girlfriend last night, just so the listeners will believe that.
Yeah. And I was saying that I was watching an interview with Scorsese, and it's a good interview series where they go to different scenes and watch it with the director.
And what is that series? What is that series so we can...
Oh, Inside Director something. He's done it with... yeah, it's not German porn. It's not literally Inside the Director. He did the same thing with De Palma. It's a British guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they were watching Goodfellas in the last scene where Leota is talking and saying, I ordered spaghetti and I got pasta with ketchup and stuff, and he's complaining, and he looks at the camera, and then it cuts to Joe Pesci looking right at the camera and shooting his gun right at the camera. And he said, now why did you put that there? And he said, oh, well, that's a direct copy of the last shot of the Great Train Robbery, where the guy's shooting his gun in front of the camera. Like, there's so many pieces that are picked up from other films,
mm-hmm.
and I, in all of Scorsese's films, because he's an encyclopedia about film history.
Yeah, he is.
How can he help but reference those films? But for use in his own music, you know,
mm-hmm.
to use in his own style.
Well, that's,
I don't
like,
see that as a fault.
No,
like
it's not
Fear,
at all.
Like with Cape Fear, he's referencing a lot of film noir, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He's referencing, you know, Shadow. He's referencing a lot of thrillers in Cape Fear.
That's true.
And even recontextualizing the Bernard Herrmann score from not only the original Cape Fear, but also from Torn Curtain. And, you know, Cape Fear is his Hitchcock film, if you will, but it's also released in that year, that 1991, in the same year as Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Scorsese, I don't think, you know, he wasn't, you know, there's no way he could have known ahead of what Lambs was going to do and how Lambs was going to come out. But it's almost as if Scorsese's Cape Fear was an answer to Silence of the Lambs, where, okay, you know, audiences, they want intense psychological horror. Well, and y'all love Silence of the Lambs. Well, let me give you something even more so, because I love Silence of the Lambs, but for me, Cape Fear is even more grueling and draining of a psychological thriller.
Do you like it better than the original?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wait, no, really? You think that De Niro's Max Cady is better than Robert Mitchum's?
I love Mitchum. I like the original Cape Fear.
Robert Mitchum is my favorite actor, so
yes,
I'm just curious
like
about
Cape
that.
Fear
and that's not an offense to you guys.
No. Look, I think the weak part of Cape Fear is De Niro. The strength of Cape Fear for me is in its title. It has a way of expressing fear.
Right.
Like,
no,
like
it does.
Few,
you're right.
Like few movies I've seen. And it's also the more fleshed out Sam Bowden character. It
mm-hmm.
is more fleshed out than Gregory Peck. They almost put Gregory Peck in that role, and essentially all Gregory Peck would have to do was just stand there because he emits that that nobility. You know, that does the job for them. But with Nick Nolte, a little shadier,
mm-hmm.
and he imbues this religious Catholic guilt overtone and what violence does to us.
Yeah.
Even at the end of the film, when they're throwing rocks at each other, and Nick
yeah.
Nolte is hunched like a caveman at that
mm-hmm.
last shot of Cape Fear.
Yeah, you couldn't do that in the 50s.
It's a thematically strong movie, which
yeah.
is,
oh, it is
very unusual for a thriller.
You know, it's also, you know, I have to say for Scorsese, you know, he's one of the few people, and he's done this twice, two remakes that are equal, if not better, than the originals.
Well, yeah, and the thing about Cape Fear, the beauty of that ending of Cape Fear is that Max Cady finds peace with himself by the end that
mm-hmm.
Sam Bowden never will. And the interesting thing is, I was telling this to someone, is that there is something to be said for when Scorsese does works for hire, be it Cape Fear, be it Color of Money, you know, Aviator, and these are works
yeah.
for hire. You know,
mm-hmm.
other directors were attacked, and then he came on. He
right.
can't help, but all of a sudden it turns into a personal film. Even The Color of Money, when we look at it now, and it looks like, and it's the template of the 80s, mid 80s to early 90s Tom Cruise vehicle of
mm-hmm.
the, you know, Top Gun, Cocktail, Days of Thunder. Color of Money falls into that, but it's the Scorsese version of a Tom Cruise vehicle, and
yeah.
therefore I think Color of Money is probably the most substantial of a those Tom Cruise vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much texture and character in that, and Scorsese can't help but do that. You know, you can almost imagine. You know, to take one step further. You know, I would love to have seen Scorsese's Top Gun. You know.
Oh, I wouldn't. I'm glad that he never did that.
Scorsese's Top Gun wouldn't be what we think of Top Gun.
No, wouldn't be at all, but I still am glad he never did it, though.
Jamie, you know this story. You might know the story. You know, Scorsese at one point, he was early on tagged to do Beverly Hills Cop, you know, back when it was like a Stallone vehicle.
Right.
I don't know if you ever heard that story.
No, but I know Stallone was attached to it originally, but
Scorsese early on was, you know, back when it was, you know, going to be a hard cop film.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese was attacked because he was in the 80s. You know, he needed to work, so he was going to be. There was talk of him death, but then Stallone left, and what did Stallone do? He went off and made The Great Cobra.
Well, you know, Aaron,
which,
you can't really say anything bad about that film because of Jason and Jamie. So, I mean, you really,
yeah, that's right.
You know, you're standing on thin ground there, man. Thin ice,
that,
my friend.
That's sacrilege, man. But Scorsese actually was going to do Schindler. Spielberg was going to do Cape Fear, and they kind of switched off.
Same
so
thing with Casino and Clockers. You know, Scorsese
right.
was going to do Clockers, and you know, with De Niro, but then Casino came up. He's like, you know what? I'll produce it, and he gave it to Spike, and it's one of Spike Lee's best films.
Yeah, yeah. So where do you think the Casino stands in his legacy? And then I want to talk a little bit about Inglourious Basterds.
I mean, I love Casino. I think it was my second. It was either my third or fourth film of that year. My first was Dead Man Walking. But, you know, it was in my top three. So, I mean, I love Casino. I mean, it's one of those films when it pops up, I can, you know, I'll watch a good chunk of it.
Yeah.
And I am of the, I remember when I first came out of the theater, and I did read a lot of those reviews. I was one of the few who actually went out of there. You know, when I would defend the film, one of the first things I would defend was Pesci's performance. And I think lazy critics, lazy viewers, just labeled it as, well, it's a Goodfellas retread. And
right.
And it's not. And the key difference is the conception of Pesci's character and performance, in that that's a character in Casino of a made man, someone who cannot be touched,
Right.
And so his, you know, brawn, as Jamie said, that gives that character more confidence than the one in Goodfellas. The one in Goodfellas, the reason he's such a, you know, a quick-tempered person is because he's not made, and therefore he has some insecurity. And so therefore, conceptually, it's two different characters and two different performances. They're both violent, but the violence is born out of different things. And also, I want to say this real quick, in that De Niro's performance, you know, De Niro in the last few years has gotten a lot of flack for not doing great work, although he's turned into a great filmmaker. The performance in Casino is a really great piece of steady, kind of minimalist, very quiet acting.
And it's particularly interesting when it's coupled with Heat, because both of these performances are very calculated, very kind of calm and smooth on the surface, very meditative almost. And it's a great side of De Niro, the underplaying that he does in both of these movies.
Well, and the great difference between the two is that in Heat, he has a fatalistic streak, where in Casino, there is something very sad by the end of what has happened to him. And he continued this kind of this exercise and kind of what can I do without the least amount of dialogue as possible, because his next great performance was just 2 years later in Jackie Brown, where, you know, he has very little dialogue.
Right.
And
nobody's perfect in that.
And that is another great minimalist De Niro performance.
Yeah. Okay. We mentioned Tarantino in relation to Scorsese. And he's been in the press a lot lately. I've seen a lot of fascinating interviews with him, like Charlie Rose. He did that the other night talking about his dream project in Inglourious Basterds. And it's interesting because what he said, you know, I don't have a capacity to judge this as my masterpiece until maybe, you know, give me like 5 years down the line. Because right now his favorite movie of his own is Kill Bill Volume 2. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, but I agree with him on that.
Yeah. So you both saw Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
I saw it twice within a 24-hour period.
I saw it
three times within the 24-hour period.
See,
can I just go ahead and talk about it at this
Please,
point,
Jerry.
Jamie?
Go ahead, man.
I will say this. I went to the midnight show with my mom. I went back to see it again the next day at noon, just myself, and I took my brother to see it the next day. If I had any doubts about this film, they're all gone. It's perfect. And what I mean by perfect is that this film is a celebration of film.
It is
everything that Tarantino's obsession with film and the obsession of making films is on full display from the first frame of the film to the very last frame. You know, a lot of people tell you, oh, the tavern scene is a little too long. That's fucking bullshit. It's perfect. The whole film is perfect.
Yeah.
If I have one complaint about this film, Michael Fassbender's not in it long enough, and he plays Archie Hilcox, the British soldier, the British film critic turned British soldier. He's not in it long enough because he has some of the film's best lines. But the film is perfect. I have no problems with it.
All the criticisms of it tend to focus around Tarantino's indulgence, but that's been a marker of Tarantino's work from the beginning. So I don't understand.
Twice, man. Yeah. I have the script right here in my hand. What do you need? Can I just say the improvements he made? There are some things I wish that he had included. There's a scene where Eli Roth is embarrassed you, and if I ever said anything bad about Eli Roth, please forgive me. His performance as Donowitz is simply perfect. But there's a flashback sequence that's not included in the finished film where he's talking to his relatives in Boston in a barbershop about why he wants to go to war with the Germans, and going to war with the Japs isn't going to do it for him. He wants to go to war against the Germans, and it's some beautiful scenes that are cut out. But there's just so much to treasure in this film. I don't even know where the fuck to begin, Jamie. I've seen it three times. I could see it three more fucking times. I could see it 30 more times, and I wouldn't know where to begin. This film is the ultimate Jewish revenge fantasy. And I would implore everyone to go, before you even go see the film, read the Jeffrey Goldberg interview with Tarantino in the Atlantic Monthly.
I really strongly recommend that.
And then go see the film. This film is perfect. I have no problem with it.
So your official quote is, this film is perfect.
This film is perfect. This is his masterpiece. And let me say this. It is the greatest last line spoken in a film since There Will Be Blood in the Clockwork Orange. That I will say right now.
All right, Aaron, share some of your thoughts.
It's funny. I have the script somewhere on my computer, but I never read it.
Buy it, Aaron. You can buy it. Dude, it's worth buying. It belongs in your library.
Well, now I'll probably, now that it's officially public, I'll probably pick up a
copy. It's not the script of the film, though. I have to warn everyone.
Well, from what I've read, talking about the scene in Boston with Donnie Donowitz, I do know that a lot of stuff was filmed and not used. So I know that was used. I know Maggie Cheung had a sequence and that wasn't used.
Let me ask you this, because you're our home video correspondent. Will this show up on the first DVD, or we're not going to be that lucky?
Probably not that lucky. Probably not.
Yeah, probably show on a future Criterion or something, I think.
Oh, I hope Criterion. I hope they have the balls to release this.
Well, and I will use Jamie's word. I do think the film is great. It is perfect. It was funny. The second time I went, I had my watch with me, and I timed certain sequences. Because to me, the film is a steady crescendo to one sequence. And this is something, and Tarantino has said this, he goes, my films up until this one is that I've subverted the ending that you think it should have, be it Kill Bill Volume 2 or Pulp Fiction or whatever. You think it's, logically it should have this ending, but I've made a career out of subverting that into something else. He goes, here is where the first time I actually had to follow through and give you the ending that we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true. This is really a film. This is a it's a 2.5-hour film. So it's basically 2 hours and 20 minutes of build-up for basically a 10-minute finale.
Mm-hmm. True.
But I understand that individual scenes work like that, too, because what he was trying to do in this film, above all others, was prove that he can create suspense in his own style using dialogue.
And so
individual sequences like the opening...
Oh, the opening is brilliant.
Opening is true. And that tavern scene is a scene. I did clock that scene from, and I don't want to tell, Jamie hasn't seen the film, so I'm purposely not telling.
Oh, I don't want to say a damn word about it. I thought Jamie would have seen this on Friday night.
He was talking to his girl.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we should all be that lucky, but I mean.
And has your girl seen it, Jamie?
No.
Okay. See, they were too busy talking to
you. But she does think that I'm an inglorious bastard. So
we're all inglorious bastards on the
show.
But
that tavern scene, what is interesting, I did time it from the first frame of the tavern scene to the last frame of the tavern scene. It's 25 minutes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And it is pretty. In fact, that's chapter 4. Operation Kino, that chapter only has 4 scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Sequences in that chapter, and that is the longest chapter in the film. That's like a 40-45 minute chapter.
Yeah,
and that chapter is pretty. That's one you could actually, a chapter you can study. And
Would you cut anything out of Operation Kino though?
No. I wouldn't.
I love this guy. This guy is okay. Thank you.
I wouldn't cut anything. Yeah. Yes, the film is 2.5 hours long, and and here's the weird thing. It feels like a 2.5-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
You do feel the time. But the thing is, it's a weird thing in that, yes, it's a long film, but you don't mind it being a long film.
Not at all.
The same way Casino is a long film. You feel the 3 hours of
Casino. Yeah, but I don't mind it, though, like you said.
Yeah, so, I mean, people who are saying, well, it's a long film, the follow-up question is, like, well, did you mind it being a long film? And chances are, a lot of them will probably stop and think and say, well, no, I didn't mind it. And so that's the thing. Yes, it's a long film. You're going to commit. I try to look at it this way. Tell people, it's 2.5 episodes of True Blood. When you watch 2.5 episodes of True Blood, it's, if you can watch Big Brother After Dark, You can watch.
Aaron, True Blood can't hold a candle to this.
No, and you know, and I'm liking True Blood.
I like True Blood too, but it just can't hold a candle to this.
Suki and the Panties, man, love that shit.
But
anyways, but as the thing, what I do love about the one of the things I do like about the film, as part of everything, is Tarantino's this international cast that he put together and just everyone kind of coming into their own. Obviously, everyone's talking about Christoph Waltz.
Yeah.
He's terrific. But it is some of these more the side guys. Diane Kruger.
She's great in this.
She comes in her own, and it comes to one of the things I've always said. You know, when people complain, oh, I don't like that actor, or I don't like anything they're in. I've always been of the mind, well, they just need the right part. Someone, you know, an extreme example is someone like Dane Cook, who I do not find funny as a stand-up, and a lot of his comedies I don't like. But if you look at him in a movie like Dan in Real Life.
Mm-hmm.
He gives a real performance.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's
yeah, we're talking about that before with Sharon Stone.
You know, same thing with Sharon. You know, Sharon Stone's a good example. So Diane Kruger, you know, she, National Treasure movies, Troy, hasn't really, you know, nothing that she can, you know.
You don't stop the presses when Troy comes on cable?
No.
I don't either. Thought maybe you might. I don't know.
I say that. You know, I like Troy. I like the ending. Troy has a great battle scene, a couple of great battle scenes.
No, it's not a bad film. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, you know.
Mike Myers is terrific. Mike Myers, he's doing some great. Mike Myers, you know.
I'd like to actually address Mike Myers in this film.
Okay.
And I like Mike Myers, but I think Quentin Tarantino, like Richard Kelly before him, has found what made the Saturday Night Live actors so great. You don't give him a full movie, you give him a scene, and he's perfect in this. Mike Myers can carry a whole movie, but a scene like this, he's perfect.
Well, what he's doing, you know, as we know from the Austin Powers film, you know, Mike Myers loved the British comedy.
He loved Casino Royale, and he loved Benny Hill.
But he also loved, and so by loving that, he also loved the British World War II movies, because really what the scene that Mike Myers is in is basically a lot of these British World War II.
It reminded me of the Carry On movies.
Right. You know, it's done in miniature, you know, with him and Rod Taylor, and, you know, it's just some terrific stuff. Now, without not saying the last line of the film, Jamie, which is a great last line.
I already know the last line of the film.
Well, God damn it, Jamie, I'm going to commit suicide now because I ruined it for you.
It was given away by Tarantino.
Son of a bitch. Okay.
What I find interesting, you know, a lot of critics coming out of Cannes and even a couple of them now, you know, they pick on that last line and say it's a real groaner, in that the both times that I've seen it, the film, you know, matinees with just normal people coming in, you know,
mm-hmm.
regular people, not film geeks or something, I think the audiences get the joke of the last line.
Yeah.
And
oh, absolutely.
So, excluding that line, what is your favorite line in the film? I have my personal.
I do have a favorite line, and it's delivered by R.T. Hillcox in the tavern scene, where he says, "There's a special rung in hell for people who waste perfectly good scotch."
Hmm.
I love that line.
My favorite is a Brad Pitt, Aldo Rain, and it's at one point, I won't say when, he says, "Nah, I get chewed out. And I've been chewed out before. You know, that's no big deal." And the way Brad Pitt said, I've been chewed out before, is just classic. In fact, Brad, you know, everyone's talking about Christoph Waltz getting nominated for his performance, and he should get nominated. Brett, like Burn After Reading, Brad Pitt's comic performance in Inglourious Basterds is award-worthy stuff. It's terrific stuff. Eli Roth, I've always been an Eli Roth fan.
But I think Eli Roth really... You know, if I may make the argument, I love Tarantino as a director. I don't like when he's in front of the camera. I think the revelation here is that Eli Roth is awesome in front of the camera.
I must say the character of Shoshana did remind me a lot of Jamie, particularly the way she would run.
I actually was thinking of someone else. I wasn't thinking of Jamie. No offense, Jamie. I wasn't thinking of you.
Yeah, but particularly why, Aaron?
Because she runs the theater. And there is a great sequence where she's setting up the reels.
Right.
I was like, oh, now I know what Jamie was doing for 20 years of his life.
That's exactly it. I'm sure it was different back in World War II, but the way that was done.
Well, you know, you never know. You know, the technology hadn't changed for quite a long time, so I'm sure.
Right. People are still watching movies that are hand cranked.
Yeah.
I just want to say one quick thing. And, you know, Gary brought up about the whole Jewish fantasy. I do think that there is a legitimate discussion that can be made about the. You know, I love the film, and the film is very moving. I do think it's Tarantino's most personal film, but what I find moving about it is his naivete of the notion of cinema can save all and what he's done, and I find that very touching.
I think it's a deeper thing than that.
It's something that he's actually expressed a lot.
Yeah.
That was the brilliant stroke that he had. That just the power of cinema, like movie, it's the movie film itself.
It
saved
there.
The day. Yeah.
And just to play devil's advocate, I do think, and the discussion has been going on. Unfortunately, it's been going on with people who aren't very smart.
I
do think there is a discussion to be made about the implications of what his fantasy has, you know, is implying. Unfortunately, the people who are objecting to the film on the morality soapbox, they have no way of really articulating that argument.
If you're on a moral
argument, could you tell me, Aaron, what
the argument is? I already know. I haven't seen it. Is that he's reversing history? Right?
Well,
I mean, they find that irresponsible. But these moralists really not have a problem with anything else Tarantino's made?
Yeah. But can I say something, though? And I need to address this because it was brought up by my brother, who's... I think what you learn from watching this movie without giving it away is that Quentin Tarantino is a firm believer in the multiple universe theory of quantum mechanics, that this is an alternative reality. And I believe that fully watching the movie and some of the images and scenes that he's taken from other movies, which is his specialty, but... forget the ultimate Jewish revenge fantasy. While it's there, he really is a firm believer in quantum mechanics. And everyone will realize what I mean when they go see this film.
Probably not, because the people that are arguing don't know what the hell quantum mechanics
are. No, but it is. It's like saying, all right, Jamie, let me put it to you like this. In an alternative universe, we exist, but we're rich, we're well-hung, and we're thin, okay? That's
well,
what
the whole conception of the Inglourious Bastards is a fiction. It's an alternative reality. But had they existed, his argument is this very well could have been possible. It's not out of the realm of imagination.
No, it's not. And I wrestled with this after, you know, we were watching this on the midnight show on Thursday, and I must tell you, the last 10 minutes, people were clapping.
Yeah,
I mean, I haven't heard applause like I've never heard applause like that.
Hadn't heard applause like that since Optimus Prime beat up on Megatron. But anyway,
never heard it during that either.
I heard it during United 93. It was kind of when they fought back against the terrorists on the plane.
Yeah.
There was visceral. Yeah,
Jamie, it was surreal. Because I was wondering where is that clapping coming from, and it's one of the most surreal things I've heard in a movie in all my life. I can't begin to describe it because it's still sinking in.
Well, you already described it, quantum mechanics.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that I did that. I'm glad that I was able to do that.
And there are a bunch of arguments. Spielberg made the Nazis look buffoonish in Raiders. And there is one interesting thing that no one's brought up. When this plan goes into effect, Operation Kino and all this stuff, it is June of 44. So I've always, when I saw the film the first time, and more so the second time, Inglourious Basterds does not deny the enormity of the Holocaust.
No, not at all.
And it's not, you know, it's not it's not rewriting history to the extent that it's, you know, making a big change. I mean, it's still happening. It's basically the end of the war, the different end of the war is what's going on here.
It's not trivializing the tragedy.
No, it's not trivializing at all. Actually, I think it's not trivializing the Holocaust at all. It's not doing anything like that. And it does pay homage to Raiders of the Lost Ark in that final 10 minutes. I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Let's take a call real quick.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good friend of the show. He called last week. 310 area code.
Hey, yeah, spoke to you guys last week. Roland calling.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, hey buddy, how you doing?
Welcome back.
I'm good. Yeah, I've only been on for the last 30 minutes, so I just caught you guys talking about Inglourious. Saw it last night, and so you guys basically think this is a big return to form for him.
I never thought he lost that form, but yeah.
How about the last movie with
Death Proof?
Death Proof is actually a.
It's not as bad as everyone says it is. Let me put it to you like this, my friend. If that's his worst film, it's better than most people's best film.
Yeah.
Well, I'm of the mind. I still have to think about this. And as much as I love Inglourious Basterds, of this decade, Kill Bill 1 and 2, Death Proof, and Death Proof might be my favorite film of Tarantino's this decade. I think Death Proof is a vastly, not only underrated, but a vastly misunderstood film, and it's actually his most feminist film.
So what do you think about Inglourious and where this stands?
Well, I was hoping, I wasn't a fan of Death Proof. I thought, yeah, I mean, I love Kill Bill 2. I think his three best films are Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction, and Reservoir Dogs. And I think in this film I was looking for, you know, I was quite open-minded, but that first scene was blistering. That was Tarantino at his best.
Yeah.
Some of this, I think, I do disagree with you guys on a lot of it. I mean, I think you guys are on a bit of a Tarantino, like, wank fest.
There's that too. But let me tell you this though, he's done something here. He's taken a lot of different elements of other films, and he's put them into his own film. And I can see where you say it's a wank fest for us and everything. But let me tell you this, he's really done something here that's it's bold. This is a guy who, when asked, "Did you see Defiance?" he said, "No, and I don't think it goes far enough." He wanted to make a Holocaust film where the Jews were not victims.
Hmm.
Now, granted, you're like saying, how the hell can you do that? How is that physically possible? But this is Tarantino. Look, it's Tarantino's world. We're just living in it, you know? We're just visiting. He's got his own rules.
It's quantum mechanics, Colin.
Yeah, it's quantum mechanics. He believed in his alternate universe, this is what, hey, you know what? I want the Jews to finally fucking win.
Yes. So, do you think we should do a show in the future called Tarantino Wankfest? I mean, just your opinion.
For you guys, don't think this film is 45 minutes too long?
No, but you and my brother thinks that too. It's like 20 minutes too long. One of
my
brothers. So.
My question to people who bring up the length of a film. My first question is, you know, it's too long. My first question is, where do you want it to cut? Because I can't see edits.
Some of the scenes just don't work. They're just too long. I mean, the scene in the bar, we all know it's going to end up in a shootout, and it just drags on and on. And from being so excited from the first scene in the film, and then, you know, by the end of the film, I'm looking at my watch.
That's where you're wrong. We don't know if that's going to end in a shootout. That's a possibility. But we
no, Aaron, we know it's going to end in a shootout.
I did not know. I mean, I knew that was a possibility. All I knew is that they need to get out of that tavern. But as one of the characters says, we need to stick around so we don't look suspicious.
That is a criticism about the movie, though, that essentially every scene is the same. I mean, it's structured the same.
And that's not true. I know the other scene that people are criticizing, there's a scene involving where Christoph Waltz, who plays the head Nazi, meets another character, and they have strudel. And there's a lot of intimidation going on.
Right.
People think that scene is just another rehash of some of these other scenes. But
right.
It's not. And the way you know that's not is that the ending, the capper of that scene reveals it to be a very moving and very heartbreaking sequence. I won't say what happens at the last beat of that scene, but if you took off the last beat of that scene, then yes, it would be like every other scene. but there is an extra beat at the end of that scene that recontextualizes everything you'd seen previously in that scene. So it's like, yes, it's similar verses, but they have different endings. And
I think Christoph Waltz really steals the film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree with that, but I also have to say I don't think Brad Pitt has ever had this much fun since True Romance.
I think Brad Pitt is actually being underrated in this film.
Now, there are other people that have brought that he's having a good time here. I mean, he has the equivalent of the Tom Cruise part in Tropic Thunder last year. I mean, he's having the time of his life here.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily a praise. I mean, I'm sure Dean Martin had a great time on Ocean's 11.
It is praise actually, because I think, you know, because Brad Pitt had a lot of fun also on the Ocean's film that he's been involved in. But Brad Pitt is actually very good here. But no, it is Christoph Waltz's film. I think this is like the most hardcore Nazi villain we've had since Conrad Veidt in Casablanca.
And he's treated as a detective of sorts. I mean,
no,
he's made more interesting
point
than a mustache twirling villain.
Yeah, he makes
would,
the point that he's
I,
a detective.
I think the most interesting or the most great, you know, I can't believe we're actually making a list of the great Nazi villains, but I think what Gary meant was Ralph Fiennes and Schindler's List.
Well, no, Ralph Fiennes is good, and I agree with that, but let's go back to the original Casablanca. It's really Conrad Veidt that he's really, I think, that and Peter O'Toole, Night of the Generals.
As much as
I love Ralph Fiennes, and he is good, but Ralph Fiennes does have a weakness in that, and that's that girl on Schindler's List.
Right.
Right.
Which makes
like
him more interesting.
Well, Hans Linda has no weakness, and let's put it like this. He's not married to the party. He is a detective, as Jamie says. He's interested in the hunt. He doesn't give a shit about ideology.
That is true. Now we're turning into a Ralph Fiennes wank fest.
Yeah, well, I mean, you want to go there, sure. And our friend here on the phone had brought up Wankfest, but yeah.
I think Ralph Fiennes is probably the greatest Nazi villain I've seen.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd go with that. He's also one of the greatest actors I've ever seen.
Yeah. And it's a character with colors, too. I mean,
yeah.
It's a character that's complicated by this relationship.
Which is odd, because it's a black and white movie. But anyway.
Great. There you go. There you go, folks.
Except
you can
for that little
bit. Too.
So do you think the red dress in Inglourious Basterds is an homage to Schindler's List?
No. Jared? I don't think Tarantino really cares that much about Spielberg until we get to Munich.
No, Tarantino, he loves Spielberg. I mean,
I actually think you're wrong there. I don't think he's that interested in Spielberg as everyone. He really has a different mindset, Aaron, when it comes to movies. He's not that interested in Spielberg.
Hmm.
When he's making this movie, Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List are not high on his list of films.
No. Well, no, they're two totally different.
Yeah, but he's really not interested in Spielberg.
Well, it's fascinating what he is interested in.
Yeah.
So,
I
saw that he had The Insider on his top 20 of
yeah.
the past 17 years.
Yeah.
That wouldn't necessarily be a movie you'd think that would interest him, but it did.
Or yeah, I mean, he has that and he has anything else on there. So, I mean.
Yeah, which is mind-boggling.
But that's him. That's who he is. He also said Showgirls was the best movie of the year when that came out.
And also he had Speed and Matrix and
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought actually I did. I love that 20, that top 20. I thought that was that actually was a good list. I thought that was.
We have a guest on the phone. I'd like to hear what his thoughts are.
On what, guys?
On whatever the fuck you want to talk about, because you took the time to call our show, and
well,
I really want to celebrate that fact.
I saw funny people the other night, and I thought that was Judd Apatow's best movie by a long way.
No kidding.
Really? I just thought it was about a bunch of nasty showbiz people, but that's just me.
Wait. And to qualify that, are you saying his best film as a director, because it's his third film, or in this whole Judd Apatow?
Yeah, the whole Judd Apatow basket.
Wow.
It was his most ambitious film. From the comedians that I know, it seems the most realistic film.
I will say, I think it's his
I
best,
agree with you there.
I think
it
his
is his most
direct,
realistic film.
I think it's his best directed film, but if we're going to bring in the Apatow universe, which is stuff he produced and or ghost writ or whatever, I'd have to go with Superbad. That's the best film, which I think is the funniest film of the decade.
Wow.
Can we end the show?
I know we went on a tangent here, but I want to ask our caller. Yes, so you say the film is Inglourious Basterds is, you know, a little long. So what's, you know, you said the tavern scene, which is, you know, which is kind of a, you know, a love it or hate it sequence. But what else do you think should have been taken out or possibly trimmed or so forth?
I think as the film goes on, it starts out so strong and he just loses his way. And then there's moments in the film which are wonderful, and glimpses which are great. But there's a lot of fat in there. I mean, there's a lot of, if you did take out 45 minutes, I think this film could be way up there in his backlog.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tarantino movies are all about the fat. So I think to criticize that.
I would like to ask our caller a question, because, you know, it is my show, and I know we have our guest caller on, but the caller called in and took the time out of his schedule to call us. I have a question for you.
Okay.
And that is this. I understand where you're coming from, because I'm getting, you know, my brother, who is a filmmaker and a screenwriter, he said the same thing that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all devout Tarantino fans, but I understand where you're coming from. Do you think the film, by the time we get to the conclusion, reminds you of the original Casino Royale, you know, the one with Peter Sellers? It has that kind of zaniness to it. When we get to the end, where they want to blow up the casino, and here we want to blow up the theater. Is that where you're getting at? It says this goes down into this Mike Myers kind of silliness.
I mean, maybe. I mean, by the end, I just didn't care.
You didn't give a shit. You were like, oh, fuck, you know, hey, if they kill them all, that's great. If they don't, that's fine. I just want to get out of the theater and go home and take a leak.
Kind of, yeah.
I want to have a Judd Apatow wank fest when I get home.
Yeah.
Just kidding. It's
I want to go get it. I want to go have a drink, basically, after this is all done. I mean, this is all. This is an alternative history. This is just bastardization at this point.
I mean, the thing is about this film, I mean, do you care what happens to anyone? Obviously, we want the German to get it by the end.
Oh,
of
I want the German
movie
to get it, but I'm just so happy. You know, here's the thing about Tarantino, and this is what to like about him. He's having such a good time. He loves films. In a year which has been really poor for films, except for a couple of films I can mention, I'm not going to do that right now. He comes out. He's passionate about the art form. The movie itself is really about the love of movies. I think you would agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love him, but I just think that Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, I think, is his masterpiece.
Oh yeah, I give you, and that you mentioned Jackie Brown. I'll come out and hang out with you and have a couple of drinks with you in a couple of weeks, but because I think that's a vastly underrated film.
Definitely. I think that is his number one masterpiece.
This guy has permanent standing on our show. He can come on whenever he wants.
All right. Thank you, caller.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you calling in. All right, we're going to close out.
Jamie, are we going to do a George Cosmatos Wankfest next week?
It's all going to be about Cobra. I mean, I don't want to be in service to
Leviathan.
We
don't need to do any other film. It's just about Cobra.
Tombstone, yo, Tombs. I'll be your Huckleberry.
Yeah. Tombstone. I like the fact that he did commentary for Cobra and Leviathan, and then Tombstone was like an afterthought.
I know.
I'll do Tombstone. All right, guys. Wednesday, we'll be back.
With Peter Hines.
Possibly, yeah.
I hope so. I pray to God.
So just stick to our blog postings and see what's up on Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.
All right, thank you.
Here's some music for Casino to close us out.